This is a recording of There's the Boy I Can Trust, Dennison Lott Harris's first-person account of the conspiracy of Nauvoo and events surrounding Joseph Smith's last charge to the 12 Apostles by Jeffrey M. Bradshaw, published in Interpreter, a Journal of Mormon Scripture, read by Jeffrey M. Bradshaw. There's the Boy I Can Trust, Dennison Lott Harris's first-person account of the conspiracy of Nauvoo and events surrounding Joseph Smith's last charge to the 12 Apostles by Jeffrey M. Bradshaw. Abstract. A well-known account from early church history describes how, in the spring of 1844, two young men, Dennison Lott Harris and Robert Scott, helped protect Joseph Smith from dissidents plotting against his life. Almost completely unknown, however, is Dennison's account of his subsequent role as a first-hand witness to events that appear to have taken place on the morning of 26th of March, 1844, just prior to a meeting which Joseph Smith gave his last charge to the Quorum of the Twelve and rolled the kingdom off his shoulders onto theirs in the presence of the Council of Fifty. This article provides the background necessary to understand all these events and publishes for the first time a complete annotated transcript of events of Dennison's 1881 verbal statement to the First Presidency Counselor Joseph F. Smith. In addition, the article includes a discussion of the significance of apostolic succession then and now, drawing in part on the encounters of Catholic scholars John M. Reiner and Stephen H. Webb with Mormonism. In the appendix, I reproduce an 1884 article from the contributor that gives a second-hand version of Dennison's account of the conspiracy of Nauvoo. For those who embrace the claims of the Restoration, there is no more significant event in the months immediately preceding the martyrdom of Joseph Smith than what occurred on 26 March 1844, when the prophet announced to a gathering of trusted brethren that he had conferred all the keys and powers that he held on selected members of the Twelve, assuring continuity in the leadership of the Church after his impending death. We possess several first-hand accounts of this meeting where this took place. However, because none of them were written until several months afterward, and since all of them were recorded by parties with potential self-interest due to their roles as participants, some have expressed frustration and doubt as to whether or not the incidents really happened as they have been reported. For example, a member of an online discussion group wrote the following, quote, "I hope I don't come across as argumentative, but I am hoping we have something other than the later recollections of those who have had an incentive to remember a secret meeting where Joseph gave them, rather than the competitors to church leadership, special authority. It seemed rather convenient to me that these recollections occur as their authority to lead the church is challenged. Nobody can remember a date. Nobody can provide meeting minutes, despite the fact that meeting minutes were religiously kept in other circumstances. I mean, we have loads of minutes from the Nauvoo High Council, the Council of 50, Relief Society, sealings, second anointings, endowments, etc., but nothing at all from the time when Joseph provided the element necessary for the work to continue after he died. If there is nothing we know of, then I suppose we have to live with that fact. I wanted to see if anyone else knew of something I had missed. Apparently not." End of quote. Actually, there is an account of these events that addresses some of these concerns. A young man named Dennison Lott Harris appears to have been a first-hand witness at the preliminaries to the Council of 50 meeting where Joseph Smith gave his last charge to the Quorum of the Twelve, stating that he had, quote, "rolled the kingdom off his shoulders," end of quote, onto theirs. Although other contemporaries testified of having heard the prophet repeat similar words on other occasions, Dennison Lott Harris is currently the only outside observer who claims to have heard Joseph Smith speak of the event on the very morning it occurred, seemingly just prior to the last charge meeting itself. Although Dennison's account was not recorded until decades after the events he reports took place, I find his description both a good fit to known circumstances and not implausible with respect to aspects of the situation for which we have no other informants. Speaking of the portion of Dennison's account that tells of the conspiracy of Nauvoo, Brian C. Hales concludes, quote, As a historical document, it has been largely dismissed because it came late and because it contained information that was not verified by corroborative sources. Notwithstanding this general reaction, my research indicates that its reliability may be greater than previously assumed. End of quote. Following a brief overview of the statement and its significance, I will discuss its historical background and provenance. I will describe some of the difficulties with the statement. Then I will provide a conjectural timeline of events, followed by an annotated transcript of the original 1881 statement. The article continues with reflections on the significance of apostolic succession in the restored church, with a focus on the encounters of Catholic scholars John M. Reiner and Stephen H. Webb with Mormonism. In Appendices 1 and 2, I reproduce an 1884 article that gives a second-hand account of Dennison's story about the conspiracy of Nauvoo and a statement by its author. Appendix 3 provides a perspective on the 1884 apostasy of William Law. Overview and significance of the statement. Dennison Lott Harris, 1825-1885, son of Emer and Deborah Lott Harris, and nephew of Book of Mormon witness Martin Harris, gathered with his parents to Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. He was 19 years old in March 1844 when the events in Nauvoo recounted in his statement took place. Harris came west with the Saints to Utah in 1852, served a mission to the Navajo in 1854, participated in the Echo Canyon campaign in the 1857 and 1858 Utah War, and brought provisions to the handcart companies on three different occasions. After a time living in Virgin City and Paragona, he moved to Monroe. At the age of 52, he was set apart as the bishop in Monroe and served until his death in 1885. Dennison's statement begins by telling of how he, along with his friend Robert Scott, was asked by the prophet to attend and report the proceedings of a series of meetings in which disaffected members of the church proclaimed Joseph Smith as a fallen prophet and were plotting to take his life. Afterward, the prophet made them promise to say nothing about their role in these events for many years, knowing that any disclosure might endanger their lives. However, in 1881, Dennison arranged for President Joseph F. Smith to hear his story, as Secretary to the First Presidency George F. Gibbs took it down in shorthand. Although the original statement he made about the conspiracy of Nauvoo has never before been published in its entirety, various versions of the story and of his heroic role in defending the life of Joseph Smith have circulated publicly since 1884. What seems to have been forgotten, so far as I've been able to determine, is Dennison's account of a second-hand incident that appears to have taken place later in the same month. Dennison tells of how one morning, as he passed Joseph Smith's red brick store in a wagon, he was asked by Elder Willard Richards to assist him in filling barrels and buckets of water and hauling them to the second store of the floor of the store for use in giving the apostles their endowments. After they had finished, Dennison remembered the prophet declaring, in words reminiscent of later written testimonies of some of the 12, quote, "This day I am going to roll this kingdom off my shoulders onto the shoulders of these my brethren," in other words, select members of the Quorum of the 12 who were present at the time, "for them to preach the gospel and gather Israel and build up the kingdom upon the foundation which I have laid," end of quote. If taken at face value, the incidents that Dennison describes seem to have occurred as part of a prologue to the meeting where Joseph Smith delivered his last charge to 9 members of the 12 in the presence of other brethren who had gathered at his invitation. More specifically, most scholars now accept that his last charge was given on 26 March 1844 at the morning session of a meeting of the Council of 50. An organization that Joseph Smith had recently formed by divine commandment to establish the political and kingdom of God on the earth. Leonard Arrington summarizes the key moments of the last charge as follows, quote, "As if he had had a foreboding of his impending death, Smith gave them a dramatic charge to bear off the kingdom. As they later recounted the moving experience, the prophet seemed depressed and opened his heart about his presentiments of the future. He explained that some important scene is near to take place, that perhaps he would be killed, and that as a precaution the 12 had received all other keys and powers that he held. Then, if God wills, I can go forward with all pleasure and satisfaction, knowing that my work is done, and the foundation laid on which the kingdom of God is to be reared." He counseled them about what lay ahead, then continued, saying, while he walked the floor and threw back the color of his coat upon his shoulders, "I roll the burthen and responsibility of leading this church off from my shoulders onto yours. Now round up your shoulders and stand under it like men, for the Lord is going to let me rest a while." After he had thus spoken, he continued to walk the floor, saying, "Since I have rolled the burthen off my shoulders, I feel as light as a cork. I feel that I am free. I thank God for this deliverance." Historical background and provenance of the statement. circumstances in which the statement was made. Immediately prior to the morning session of the Ephraim, Utah State Conference on Sunday, 15 May, 1881, Dennison Lott Harris, Bishop of the Monroe, Utah Ward, approached First Presidency Counselor Joseph F. Smith with a request. For nearly four decades, Bishop Harris had held in confidence information about his role as a 19-year-old boy in two important incidents that had taken place in the spring of 1844 in Nauvoo. At last, he felt it was time to relate these stories to President Smith so they could be preserved permanently as part of the history of the church. Accordingly, after the morning meeting, Bishop Harris accompanied President Smith, Elder Franklin Spencer, and Secretary to the First Presidency, George F. Gibbs, to the home of Ephraim South Ward Bishop Carl C. N. Darius. Over a meal between conference sessions, Bishop Harris related his stories while Brother Gibbs took notes in Pittman shorthand. Expressing subdued frustration at the constrained circumstances under which he was obliged to do his work, Gibbs commented, quote, "As the afternoon meeting had been announced to commence half an hour earlier than usual, so as to give President Taylor and the party an opportunity to make Moroni and Fountain Green that evening on their way home, the time at our disposal to hear Brother H., also to eat dinner, was not sufficient to enable him to do justice to it. He told it in his own way, and had to hurry at that," end of quote. No doubt the typescript was made after Gibbs returned to his office in Salt Lake City. Description of the document. The only extant version of the verbal statement exists as an 8-page typescript original preserved at the Church History Library in Salt Lake City, Utah. The document was formally reviewed and cleared for release in January 2015, and on March 29, 2016, I received written confirmation that the document was out of copyright and could be used without restriction. On 23 March 2010, I was kindly assisted by Jay Burrup of the Church History Library, who had previously cataloged the Joseph F. Smith papers, in an effort to locate a manuscript behind the typescript. After a preliminary search, I found an affidavit from a church member reporting regarding early incidents in church history that, like the Dennison-Harris statement, had been recorded by George F. Gibbs in 1881. The affidavit was in the form of a longhand manuscript in the handwriting of Gibbs, giving us hope that a similar manuscript might exist for the Harris statement. However, after completing a more complete search for an original manuscript, Burrup wrote me to say that he had no luck in finding the document in the Joseph F. Smith papers. In light of our lack of success, Burrup mentioned the likelihood that Gibbs typed the Harris statement directly from his shorthand notes and then disposed of them immediately afterward. Related accounts. In a statement made on 8th August 1932, Horace Cummings, the author of the better-known 1884 contributor version of Harris' story, said that the genesis of his article was when he personally heard Dennison Lott Harris relate the story of the conspiracy of Nauvoo to his parents during the spring conference of 1883. He also stated, quote, "Before submitting the article to the press, at the request of President John Taylor, I read it to him line by line as he was in Nauvoo at the time the narration deals with, and the incident happened, and of course was with the prophet at the time he was killed. He was familiar with many of the things to which the article refers, and added certain elements to the story. When completed, President Taylor gave it his hearty approval for publication as a valuable document concerning church history, which had never before been published." End of quote. Within the annotations for the transcript of the Harris statement given later in the present article, I include a few minor details that appear in the contributor article that are not part of the 1881 narration. Significantly, however, although the 1884 article by Cummings was said to have been derived from an independent telling of the story, it matches the 1881 account closely in structure, and in some places the wording is nearly identical. Tellingly, the misspellings of two of the names of the conspirators given in the 1884 article matched the 1881 account precisely. If Horace Cummings had no access to the 1881 account when he wrote his 1884 article, we must suppose that Harris remembered and repeated significant portions of the account nearly verbatim in each instance, and that the substance was captured exactingly in the separate notes of Gibbs and Cummings. However, it seems unlikely that Cummings would have been able to capture Harris's words in longhand with the same precision and detail that Gibbs captured them in shorthand. In addition, while I see no reason to question Cummings' statement that he read the article to President Taylor, John Taylor, I am doubtful about his claim that certain elements were added to the account as a result. In comparing the 1881 and 1884 accounts, I saw no instance where details about the events not mentioned in the 1881 statement might have been known independently by President Taylor and contributed to the 1884 article. Cummings asserts that sometime prior to the 1887, another version of Dennison's account was told to Brigham Young and recorded by George F. Gibbs, at that time acting secretary to the first presidency. Quote, "The first time that it, namely Harris's story of the conspiracy, was revealed was at the dedication of the St. George Temple, when Brother Harris revealed it to President Brigham Young, whereupon President Young called in Brother Gibbs, who took the narration in shorthand for church record purposes." End of quote. Cummings' assertion that Dennison related the story to Brigham Young, quote, "at the dedication of the St. George Temple," end of quote, resembles an undocumented Harris tradition that was published in 1983 by a family biographer. Quote, "The year before Brigham Young died, Den invited him to stay at the Harris family's home in Monroe while en route to St. George. Den then related the foregoing story. President Young said it cleared up many otherwise unanswered questions concerning the plots against the prophet." However, the fact that no other record made by George F. Gibbs of Dennison's account has been found other than the one recorded in Ephraim in 1881 raises a question as to whether or not Cummings may have conflated the two different events, or perhaps was mistaken altogether about a meeting having taken place between Harris and Brigham Young. In the records relating to the 1881 and 1884 accounts, there is no evidence to suggest that either President John Taylor, President Joseph F. Smith, or George F. Gibbs were aware of an earlier version of the story when they heard it in 1881 or 1883. Difficulties with the statement. Dating of the events described by Harris. Harris states that the events relating to the conspiracy meetings occurred in the spring of 1844. If we accept his recollection that the meetings of the conspirators took place on three successive Sundays at face value, and if we assume that the last of the three meetings took place 1 week prior to Joseph Smith's public disclosure of the conspiracy on the Temple stand on 24th of March, we arrive at the conjectural timeline that follows in the next section. This timeline also accords with Harris's remembrance of an encounter with Joseph Smith and the 12 at the Red Brick Store that happened 2 or 3 weeks, or a few months, after the conspiracy meetings. Unfortunately, William Law, who seems to be the only diarist among the conspirators, has a gap in his 1844 journal for the presumed dates of the conspiracy meetings. The last entry prior to the lacuna is 13 January, 5 days after Law heard from Joseph Smith that he had been released as counselor in the first presidency. Entries in the journal resume on 29 March, 5 days after Law had been publicly named by Joseph Smith as one of the group who had conspired against his life. Another possibility for dating the meeting assumes that Dennison was mistaken about the order of events and that the first conspiracy meeting he attended took place in April, following his encounter with Joseph Smith and the 12 at the Red Brick Store on 26 March. William Law was excommunicated on 18 April and records in his 21 June 1844 diary entry that, quote, "Since our conference April 21st, we have held public meetings every Sabbath day," end of quote. The Warsaw Signal reports that on 12 May 1844, quote, "there were about 300 assembled at Mr. Law's house in Nauvoo," end of quote, roughly matching Dennison's statement that for the third meeting they attended in the home of William Law, the crowd numbered in the neighborhood of 200 persons. Mitigating against the likelihood that the meetings Harris described occurred in April, however, is not only that such a timeline contradicts the sequence of events in the Harris statement, but also that the meetings from 21 April onward were described as being public, per William Law. This stands in contrast to both to Harris's descriptions of the closely guarded meetings he attended, and also to a separate description of a secret meeting to be held in March, per Joseph Jackson. Moreover, the primary concerns of the April meeting seem to have been plans for the publication of the Nauvoo Expositor and Reform, the organization of a new church with William Law at its head. In his report, Harris describes no such agenda. Instead, his statement focuses on efforts to stir up additional support to help carry out with immediacy the murderous intentions that were fomented by individuals enraged at Joseph Smith and his teachings. A conspiracy of this sort, forged in secret meetings, is not only reported by Harris, but also in two separate affidavits, made in late March by men loyal to the prophet, and exposed to the public by Joseph Smith on the 24th of the same month. That the series of Sabbath day meetings at the Law Home that began on 21 April paralleled those described by Harris with regard to timing, location, and estimated number of attendees might simply imply that the public meetings that began on 21 April resumed the same pattern that had been established previously for a series of secret meetings held in March. With respect to the timing of the events reported as having taken place at the Red Brick Store, Dennison seems confident that they occurred after the conspiracy meetings. The imprecision of his description, quote, a few months after the thing I have related, perhaps it was 2 or 3 weeks, I do not now remember, I did not rivet dates on my mind, end of quote, is not surprising, given the passage of time and the fact that the exact dates are more easily forgotten than other more salient details of personal events. If we can trust Dennison's recollection of the prophet's words, quote, this day I am going to roll this kingdom off my shoulders, end of quote, he would seem to have been speaking on 26 March 1844, consistent with scholarly consensus on the dating of the last charge meeting. Based on that assumption, and because it is known that the meeting started at 9 o'clock a.m. that morning, the encounter with Dennison would have had to have taken place prior to that time. The need for some specific instruction to the 12 prior to the morning session with the entire council does not seem implausible. Moreover, it would have been prudent for the attendees of such a confidential meeting to stagger their arrivals so as not to attract undue attention. Although the possibility that Joseph Smith's statement to Harris about his delegation of responsibility to the 12 occurred sometime after 26 March 1844 cannot be ruled out, it seems unlikely to me that Dennison would have misremembered the gist of the prophet's implication that his charge to the 12 was imminent rather than retrospective. Performing an endowment on the same day as the last charge meeting. Dennison Harris understood that the barrels of water that he helped gather and raise to the upper story of the Red Brick Store were needed because, quote, Brother Joseph wanted to give them, the 12, their endowments, end of quote. That the prophet had requested James H. Rollins to help bring water to the upper floor of the Red Brick Store for endowments on at least one other occasion lends credence to the kind of situation described in the Harris account. However, Dennison's understanding that the endowments were to be given to the 12 is a puzzle because all the apostles who were or could have been present for the last charge meeting had already been endowed, and all except Amasa Lyman had also been sealed to their wives and had received the fullness of the priesthood. Although one might argue that the endowment might have been redone for the sake of the 12 at an additional time for symbolic or instructional purposes, on this occasion, it would not only seem uncalled for and unnecessary, but also inappropriate. Moreover, since it is known that during the morning session of the Council of 50 meeting on 26 March, there was no discussion or exercise of priesthood keys, no ordinations, no ordinances, no discussion of temple teachings or other church doctrine, per Ronald K. Esplin, any such ordinances would have had to have been performed at an unseasonably early hour, inconsistent with other endowment sessions which were performed in the afternoon, so they could be completed and the upper floor could be set up for the 9 a.m. council meeting. In light of these considerations, it seems possible that in his account, Harris inadvertently conflated two events. His encounter with Joseph and the 12 at the Red Brick Store on 26 March, quote, 2 or 3 weeks, end of quote, after the conspiracy meetings, and another occasion when some of the 12 were called upon to assist in giving the endowments to other brethren later that spring, quote, a few months after, end of quote. Confirming the plausibility of a time frame in the later spring for such an event, James H. Rollins related an experience where he was asked to bring water to the upper story of the Red Brick Store for use in giving endowments to some of the brethren. He said that this took place a few days before another event that occurred about the 1st of May, 1844. Moreover, it is known that John P. Green and Sidney Rigdon received their endowments on 11 May, 1844, and that Alman W. Babbitt and William B. Smith received theirs on 12 May, 1844, and that Lyman White received his on 14 May, 1844. These endowments, all given prior to Brigham Young's departure from Nauvoo on 21 May, 1844, would fit Harris's recollection of an event that would have taken place, quote, a few months after, end of quote, the meetings of the conspiracy in March, and a date of either the 12 or 14 May would be consistent with his remembrance that the prophet was intending to give endowments to the 12, in other words, either to William B. Smith or Lyman White. Conjectural timeline of events. Sometime before 3rd March. Sometime before 3 March 1844, Austin A. Cowles, a neighbor, may have invited Dennison Lott Harris and his father Emer to a meeting of conspirators that was to be held on the following Sunday at William Law's brick house. Dennison learned that Robert Scott, who had been reared by William Law, had also been invited to the meeting. Emer went to the prophet and was told that he should not attend the meeting himself, but that he should send the boys to him to receive instructions. Sunday, 3 March. In harmony with the guidance received in the morning from Joseph Smith, Robert Scott and Dennison Harris may have attended a meeting of the conspirators on this date and learned of the murderous intentions against the prophet. Sunday, 10 March. On this date, Harris and Scott may have attended their second meeting and then reported to Joseph Smith. The prophet told them that they should attend a third time. Monday, 11 March. Joseph Smith presided at the first organizational meeting of the Council of 50. The members were strictly enjoined to keep the existence and proceedings of the meetings of the council confidential. Wednesday, 13 March, Joseph Smith met with the Council of 50. Thursday, 14 March, Joseph Smith met with the Council of 50. Friday or Saturday, 15 or 16 March, Abiathar B. Williams and Marinus G. Eaton were approached by Joseph H. Jackson, Robert D. Foster, and Chauncey L. Higby with accusations against Joseph Smith. These included the insinuation that the prophet had tried to seduce Foster's wife. Williams and Eaton were strongly urged to join a, quote, secret meeting, probably tomorrow evening, but as it was not decided, he could not say positively as to the time, end of quote. Sunday, 17 March. In the morning of 17 March, Harris and Scott may have gone to see Joseph Smith as they had been instructed. The prophet told them their third meeting, would be their last, and that the conspirators would come to some determination, but that they should not join or speak in support of the conspiracy. After a dangerous escape from the meeting, Harris and Scott met with Joseph Smith and John Scott, Robert's brother, and a bodyguard to the prophet. Harris said that after considerable conversation, Joseph Smith put a seal on our mouths and told us not to tell nobody, not even our fathers, for 20 years, end of quote. Tuesday, 19 March, Joseph Smith met with the Council of 50. Saturday, 23 March, in order to counter the accusations against the prophet that Robert D. Foster had made in the presence of Williams and Eaton on 15 or 16 March, Joseph Smith rode with William Clayton and Alexander Niebauer to secure a statement from Foster's wife. Joseph Smith's journal mentions that he spent the day in counseling, in other words, in a meeting with Foster's wife. Though some have proposed that the last charge occurred on this day, there could have been no meeting held that involved Willard Richards or Wilford Woodruff, who spent their day otherwise engaged apart from the prophet. Sunday, 24 March. Joseph Smith preached at 10 a.m. His journal records, quote, on the stand I related what was told me yesterday by Mr. Marinus G. Eaton, that William Law, Wilson Law, Robert D. Foster, Chauncey L. Higby, and Joseph H. Jackson had held a caucus, designing to destroy all the Smith family in a few weeks, end of quote. No doubt out of concern for the safety of Harris and Scott, Joseph Smith did not mention them as additional informants. Tuesday, 26 March. If the Harris statement can be trusted in this regard, Joseph Smith stood on the porch with the 12 gathered around him sometime before the 9 o'clock a.m. on this date and declared to Dennison, quote, this day I am going to roll this kingdom off my shoulders onto the shoulders of these my brethren, in other words, selected members of the Quorum of the 12 who were present at this time, end of quote. Dennison's remembrance seems to anticipate events that took place sometime between 9 a.m. and 12 p.m. on the morning of 26 March, when the prophet gave the last charge to 9 members of the Quorum of the 12 in the presence of members of the Council of 50. On 19 March 1897, President Wilford Woodruff summarized his recollection of this event as follows, quote, I bear my testimony that in the early spring of 1844 in Nauvoo, the prophet Joseph Smith called the 12 apostles together, and he delivered unto them all the ordinances of the church and the kingdom of God, and all the keys and powers that God had bestowed upon him he sealed upon our heads. He told us that we must round up our shoulders and bear off this kingdom, or we would be damned. At that meeting he began a speech of about 3 hours upon the subject of the kingdom. His face was as clear as amber, and he was covered with a power that I have never seen in an instant in the flesh before. End of quote. It should be noted that Wilford Woodruff's statement telescopes events that occurred over an extended period of time as if they all happened on 26 March 1844. All the ordinances, keys, and powers mentioned had already been given to the apostles prior to that date. Wednesday, 27 March. Marinus G. Eaton and Abiathar R. B. Williams made affidavits before Daniel H. Wells about the statements that Joseph H. Jackson, Robert D. Foster, Chauncey L. Higbee made to them on 15 or 16 March. Thursday, 18 April. On the evening of this day, a council was held where Robert D. Foster, Wilson Law, William Law, Jane Law, and Howard Smith were excommunicated from the church. Suspecting their own lives were threatened, Foster and Higbee swore that they would shoot the mayor, namely Joseph Smith. Sundays, 21, 28 April, 5 May. In a renewed effort to oppose the prophet, William Law began holding public meetings in his home each Sunday, beginning 21 April. On 28 April, he became president of a new short-lived church. If the conspiracy meetings attended by Harris did not occur in March, the three successive Sundays of 21 and 28 April and 5 May might provide a second option for dating. From his careful study of the matter, Andrew E. Hatt concludes William Law's antagonism to the prophet would have reached its zenith about this time. Saturday, Sunday, and Tuesday, 11, 12, and 14 May. Dennison described how, subsequent to the conspiracy meetings, he drove his wagon, at the request of Elder Willard Richards, down to the river to fill barrels and buckets of water and haul them to the upper story of the red brick store for use in giving endowments. Joseph Smith's journal records that endowments were given to 5 of the brethren on these dates, including 2 apostles. Verbal statement of Dennison Lott Harris with annotations. Sunday, 15 May, 1881. Verbal statement of Dennison Lott Harris of Monroe, Sevier County, Utah, made by him to President Joseph F. Smith in the presence of Elder Franklin Spencer at the house of Bishop Darius of Ephraim, San Pete County, Utah, on Sunday afternoon, May 15, 1881. Reported by George F. Gibbs. Statement of Bishop Dennison L. Harris of Monroe, Sevier County, as related to him in the presence of Presidents Joseph F. Smith and Franklin Spencer at Ephraim, St. Pete County on Sunday, May 15, 1881, and reported by G. F. Gibbs. In the spring of 1844, I was invited by Austin A. Cowles, who was at the time a member of the High Council, to attend a secret meeting. I was also asked to invite my father. The meeting was to be held on the following Sunday at William Law's Brick House. There was another young man by the name of Robert Scott, who was also invited by William Law to attend the same meeting. Being intimate friends, we found out during the week that both of us had been invited to attend the same meeting. I told my father about this meeting, and he went immediately to Brother Joseph, who lived some 2.5 miles distant, and informed him of the same. Joseph told my father to send the boys to him, but for him, my father, not to go to the meeting nor to pay any attention to it. When Sunday morning came, Robert Scott, the young man referred to as my intimate friend, and I went and saw Brother Joseph. After telling him about receiving the invitation, he instructed us to go to this meeting and pay strict attention and do the best we could to learn and remember all the proceedings. We went. At that meeting, they were counseling together and working up the system and planning how to get things the best. They were opposed to the doctrine of plurality of wives, which was the cause of their conspiring against Joseph. On being asked who were present, Brother Harris said, "As near as I can recollect, William and Wilson Law, Austin A. Cowles, the Higbees, Francis and Chauncey, Robert Foster, and Brother, and 2 of the Hickses. I am positive of these, and there were a great many others of a similar character. Marks was not present at all. I think Jason W. Briggs was there. Also Finch and Rawlinson, merchants and enemies to the church, were there. This was their first meeting. They were plotting how and what they could do against Joseph. The next, page 2, verbal statement of Bishop Denison L. Harris continued. The next Sunday we attended again, having received an invitation to come back. And when they told us to come again on the next Sabbath, they told us to keep quiet what had passed at the meeting and to say nothing to our fathers or anybody else. We reported to Joseph the proceedings as far as they went. Joseph said, "Boys, come and see me next Sunday morning and go on to the meeting." We did so. They went on with their arrangements and agreed to make further arrangements during the week. They worked this up considerably that Sunday, still gave us an invitation to attend the following week. Joseph told us to go again, this being the third Sunday, and was desirous that we should see and learn all that took place on this day. "For," said he, "this will be your last meeting. This will be the last time they will admit you to their council, and they will come to some determination. But be sure," he continued, "that you make no covenants, nor enter into any obligations whatsoever with that party. Be strictly reserved, and make no promise either to conspire against me or any portion of the community. Be silent, and do not take any part in their deliberations." That day we were received and welcomed by William Law and Austin Cowles. We passed up the alley. On each side there were men with guns and bayonets on them, and when we got to the door there were men on guard, armed in the same way. Before we went to this meeting, Brother Joseph said to us, "Boys, this day will be their last meeting, and they may shed your blood, but I hardly think they will do so, as you are so young, but they may. If they do, I will be like a lion in their path. Don't flinch. If you have to die, die like men. You will be martyrs to this cause, and your crown can be no greater." But, said he again, "I hardly think they will shed your blood." We went, as I have said, to the house of meeting and passed the guards. There was a great deal of counseling going on with each other, and every little while Austin Cowles would come and sit by my side and put his arm around my neck to ascertain how I felt with regard to their proceedings. And at the same time William Law would do the same thing with Robert Scott. They talked about Joseph, denouncing him and accusing him. We told them that we did not know anything against Joseph or about the things they were charging him with, that we were only young men, and therefore had nothing to say. They would then try to convince us by relating things to us against him, but we told them that we knew nothing about them and did not understand them, that we had been reared in the church and had always esteemed Brother Joseph highly. Robert had been reared by William Law, and I had been a neighbor to Austin Cowles, and consequently they esteemed us as friends, and we did them. They continued to persuade us, we being the only ones who did not sympathize with their proceedings, but they failed to convert us. Finally, they went on to administer the oath to those present. Each man was required to come to the table and hold up the Bible in his right hand, when Brother Higbee would say, "Are you ready?" When the man being sworn answered yes, he would say, "You solemnly swear before God and all holy angels, and these your brethren, by whom you are surrounded, that you will give your life, your liberty, your influence, your all for the destruction of Joseph Smith and of his party, so help you God." Each one was sworn in that way, numbering in the neighborhood of 200 persons, and they were all sworn before us before we were called on. There were also three women brought in who testified that Joseph Smith and others, Hiram among them, had tried to seduce them into this spiritual marriage and wanted them for their wives and also wanted to lie with them. They also made an oath before this justice, after which they were escorted out of the room by the back door. After all in the room had taken the oath, but Robert and me, we were labored with by those two brethren, William Law and Austin Cowles. They sat us together side by side, with Brother Cowles on one side and Brother Law on the other. Their arguments were to try to convince us that Joseph was wrong, that he was in transgression, that he was a fallen prophet, and that the church would be destroyed except that we'd be taken, that action be taken against him, a strong one that would tell, etc. We told them that we were young, that we were not members of the High Council, and that we knew nothing at all about their charges. They then told us that Joseph had read the revelation on celestial marriage to the High Council, and that Joseph had instructed them in this revelation, and that he had tried to make them believe it. After laboring with us in this way, with a view of trying to get us to take the oath, we told them that we could not do it. They then told us that they were combining and entering into a conspiracy for the protection and salvation of the church, and that if we refused to take the oath, they would have to kill us. They said they could not. They said, let us go out with the information that we had gained, because it would be not safe to do so. And someone spoke up and said, dead men tell no tales. They gathered around us, and after threatening, they perceived that we could not be paid for, verbal statement of Bishop Denison L. Harris continued, that we could not be frightened into it. They again commenced to persuade and advise us in this way. Boys, do as we have done. You are young. You will not have anything to do in this affair, but we want that you should keep it a secret and act with us. We then told them that we positively could not. They then said that if we did not yield to their requirement, that they would have to shed our blood. And they went so far as to start us downstairs in charge of two men armed with guns with bayonets. And William and Wilson Law, Austin Cowles, and one of the Fosters started downstairs into the cellar. And there they said that they would cut our throats if we refused to take the oath. We told them positively that we would have to die then because we could not receive the oath, but that we desired to be turned loose. They said they could not turn us loose with the information we had received because it would not be safe to do it. They then walked us off with one man on each side of us, armed with sword and bowie knife, and two men behind us with loaded guns, cocked with bayonets on them. We were started to the cellar, but we had not gone more than 15 feet when someone cried out, hold on, let us talk this matter over. We were stopped when they commenced to counsel among themselves, and I distinctly remember one of them saying that our fathers knew where we were, and that if we never returned it would at once cause suspicion and lead to trouble. They became very uneasy about it, for if they shed our blood it would be dangerous for them, as it was known where we were. Finally they concluded to let us go if we would keep our mouths shut. We were escorted out, and they hated to let us go. They took us toward the river and still cautioned us about being silent and keeping secret everything we had seen and heard. For, said they, if we opened our mouths about it, they would kill us anywhere, that they would consider it their duty to kill us, whenever or wherever the opportunity afforded, either by night or by day. I told them that it would be to our interest and to our peace and safety never to mention it to anyone. They said they were glad that we could see that, and after warning us in strong terms, and before the guard left us, I saw Brother Joseph's hand from under the bank of the river. He was beckoning us to him. They turned back, but were yet watching us and listening to us, and one of us said, let us go toward the river. The guard made answer and said, yes, you'd better go to the river. With this, we started off on the run, and we ran past where Brother Joseph was, and Brother Scott was with him. Brother John Scott was with him. He was one of his bodyguard. They slipped. Verbal statement of Bishop Denison L. Lott Harris, page 5. Around the bank and came down to the same point where we were, and these men, the guard went back. We all walked down to the river quite a piece, nearly quarter of a mile, nearly opposite Joseph's store, under the bank near Joseph's residence. It was the afternoon. We got in a little kind of wash and were inside Joseph's enclosure where the board fence came down into the river. Joseph said, let us sit down here. We sat down. Joseph said, boys, we saw the danger you were in, and we were afraid you would not get out alive, but we are thankful that you got off. He then asked us to relate the results of the meeting. We told him all that had happened. We also told him the names of those who were there. After Joseph heard us, he looked very solemn indeed, and he said, O brethren, you do not know what this will terminate in. He looked very solemn, and not being able to control himself, he broke right out. Brother Scott rose up and, putting his arms around Brother Joseph's neck, said, O Brother Joseph, Brother Joseph, do you think they are going to kill you? And they fell on each other's neck and wept bitterly for some time, and we all wept. After Brother Joseph recovered himself, Brother John repeated the same question. Brother Joseph lifted Brother John's arms from off his neck and said, I fully comprehend it, but he would not say that he was going to be killed. But he said in the conversation, brethren, I am going to leave you. I shall not be with you long. It will not be many months until I shall have to go. Brother John said, Brother Joseph, are you going to be slain? He never answered, but he still felt very sorrowful. After considerable conversation, Joseph said that he would go away and would not be known among the people for 20 years or upwards. Finally, he said, "I shall go to rest," but he did not say a word about dying. "You know, Brother Joseph," here the speaker addressed himself to Brother Joseph F. Smith, "that the prophet started to go over the river just before he gave himself up to go away. It might be that he intended or meant that he would leave the place, and it might be that he knew his life would be taken. I could not say as to that." Before leaving, Joseph put a seal upon our mouths and told us to tell nobody, not even our fathers, for 20 years. He cautioned us very seriously, and I did as he told me. There was one thing that Joseph said which I have not related. He said, "They accuse me of polygamy and of being a false prophet and many other things which I do not now remember. But," said he, "I am no false prophet. I am no impostor. I have had no dark revelations. I have had no revelations from the devil. I have made no revelations. I have not got anything up myself. The same God that has thus far dictated and directed me and inspired me and strengthened me in this work gave me this revelation and commandment on celestial and plural marriage, and the same God commanded me to obey it. He said to me that unless I accept it and introduce it and practice it, I together with my people should be damned and cut off from this time henceforth. And they say, if I do so and so, they will kill me. What shall I do? What shall I do? If I do not practice it, I shall be damned with all my people. If I do teach it and practice it and urge it, they say they will kill me, and I know they will. But," said he, "we have got to observe it, that it was an eternal principle, that it was given to him by way of commandment and not by way of instruction. That is about all." Brother Harris then related the following circumstance in connection with Joseph's giving the 12 their endowments. This little circumstance took place a few months after the things I have related. Perhaps it was 2 or 3 weeks. I do not now remember. I did not rivet dates upon my mind. I was passing Joseph's brick building, which was used for a store, when Brother Willard Richards came out and beckoned me. As we approached each other, he said, "Good morning, Brother Harris," and shook hands with me. I was on my wagon, and I thought as though he wanted to chat. He walked along, and I drove on, he walking alongside of my wagon. It was an ox team that I had, but I asked him if he was going my way and if he would ride. He said, "Yes, if you please." He got up and rode. As soon as he was seated in the wagon, he said, "I have a message for you. Brother Joseph wanted me to come and see you. As soon as he saw you coming, he remarked, 'There, brethren, we are all right now. The time has come. There is the man I want. There's the boy I can depend upon and trust. Brother Richards, will you go and see him and tell him what I want?'" Then Brother Richards told me that Brother Joseph had met in that building with most of the 12, and that they had been waiting for someone that Joseph could depend upon to assist him. He then told me that Joseph desired me to drive around to the river, where he, Brother Richards, would meet me with barrels and buckets to assist him to get some water up to the... Page 7, verbal statement of Bishop Denison Lott Harris. House in which the brethren had gathered, that Brother Joseph wanted to give them, the 12, their endowments. I went to the river according to request and found Brother Richards there with barrels and buckets. We loaded up the wagon and drove up to the house the back way. The 12 were on the porch above with block and tackle with which they drew up the barrels of water. Brother Joseph was with them and assisted. Brother Joseph said to me, "This day I am going to roll this kingdom off my shoulders onto the shoulders of these my brethren, for them to preach the gospel and gather Israel and build up the kingdom upon the foundation which I have laid. For I shall not be known among these, the people, for many years, or for 20 years. I am going to rest, and these, my brethren and the 12, have got to preach the gospel and gather Israel," etc. In answer to a question, Brother Harris said, quote, "Joseph was then addressing himself to me, while the 12 stood around him on the porch. He then said to me, 'You are the only witness on the earth to what I am about to do. I wanted you as a witness, and I have been waiting for you.' Then turning to Brother Brigham, he said, 'Brother Brigham, when this temple, the Nauvoo Temple, is finished, will you see to the giving of this young man his endowments as I will give them to you today?' Brother Brigham answered, 'I will, Brother Joseph.' Brother Joseph remarked again, 'I request you to do it.' Brother Brigham promised in his firm way that he would do it. Brother Joseph then told me that was all I could do for him, and I drove off. Brother Young fulfilled his promise. When he was ready for me, he sent Brother Milo Andrews to inform me that Brother Brigham would give me my endowments if I would go to the temple. I went and received them. N.B. This statement was made under the following circumstances. Brother Harris spoke to Brother Joseph F. immediately before the foregoing forenoon meeting of Sunday, saying that he would like to relate the foregoing to him. Consequently, an appointment was made, and Brother Joseph F. asked me to be present to take what Brother Harris might say in shorthand. The time appointed was after the morning meeting. As the afternoon meeting had been announced to commence half an hour earlier than usual, so as to give President Taylor and his party an opportunity to make Moroni and Fountain Green that evening on the way home, the time at our disposal to hear Brother H. and also eat dinner was not sufficient to enable him to do justice to it. He told it in his own way and had to hurry at that. G. F. Gibbs, reporter. Reflections on the significance of apostolic succession in the restored church. The question of authority was central to the acceptance of many early converts that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was the only true and living church upon the face of the whole earth. Often, a satisfying answer to this question was found in claims of apostolic succession. Matthew J. Groh provides the following example, quote, "In 1846, Orrin Brownson, the older brother of the famed Catholic convert Orestes A. Brownson, penned a letter to his brother recounting a dream Orestes had shared with him much earlier. In the dream, Orestes, Orrin, and a third brother, Daniel, were traveling a road together. You first left the road, then myself, and it remained to be seen whether Daniel will turn out of the road," in other words, change his opinion. Orrin wrote, "At approximately the same period in which Orestes converted to Catholicism because no other church possessed proper authority, Orrin joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because he believed that proper authority rests among the Mormons." End of quote. Despite Joseph Smith's early affection for Methodism, one of his final sermons contended that the arguments of Catholics and Mormons for apostolic succession made their claim superior to those of any other church. Quote, "The old Catholic Church is worth more than all the other churches. Here is a principle of logic, that men have more sense. I will illustrate with an old apple tree. Here jumps off a branch and says, 'I am the true tree, and you are corrupt.' If the whole tree is corrupt, how can any true thing come out of it? The character of the old ones have always been slandered by all apostates since the world began." End of quote. In our time, unlike the early days of the Church, both the assertion of Mormonism's unique authority and the very idea there is only one true and living church upon the face of the whole earth are seen as repugnant or simply irrelevant to many religious seekers. Indeed, one is often led to wonder whether even the Latter-day Saints themselves fully appreciate the importance of the restoration of all priesthood keys to Joseph Smith by heavenly messengers and the continuity of apostolic succession that has prevailed in the Church since that time. The significance of Mormonism's claims to unique authority has not been lost on thoughtful observers from outside the Church. Perhaps the best-known example of this comes from Dr. John M. Reiner, a Catholic scholar, who spoke with Elder Orson F. Whitney during a visit to Salt Lake City in 1898. His words echo the sentiment of Joseph Smith quoted above, quote, "If we," in other words, the Catholic Church, "have the apostolic succession from St. Peter as we claim, there is no need of Joseph Smith and Mormonism. But if we have not that succession, then such a man as Joseph Smith was necessary, and Mormonism's attitude is the only consistent one. It is either the perpetuation of the gospel from ancient times or the restoration of the gospel in the latter days." End of quote. In a discourse given in the Salt Lake Tabernacle during his visit, Dr. Reiner elaborated more fully on his views. Quote, "To my mind, your church and the Roman church are the only true churches in the world today that make any real claim to Christianity. Have you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? There is absolute silence unless a voice comes from one corner of the Alps, from Rome, and says, 'I have the truth,' and then it comes again from another corner of the world, in this new hemisphere, from Salt Lake City, where the head of your church says, 'We have the truth.' Or, as the venerable head of the church said to me, 'If you have any truth that I have not got, let me see it, and I will take it.' These are the two churches. I do trust and hope that if you are really the true church, then your light may shine before men so that none of them shall be deprived of it. However, I am glad to say this: whether you are or not, I must confess that I have traveled pretty much near all over the world, and whether, but as a rule, I never pay much attention whether a man says he is a Presbyterian or a Primitive Methodist or a Wesleyan Methodist. It has no charm for me, but your humble missionaries buttonhole me everywhere, telling me they are the only true church, and I stand aghast and look. Therefore, my attention is arrested, and therefore I examine. What the result will be, God only knows. Admittedly, Dr. Reiner's view on the exclusive claims of Mormonism and Catholicism to legitimate authority would be even more unusual today than they were in 1898. However, the claim for apostolic authority in Catholicism and Mormonism retains its appeal for at least some scholars today, is evidenced in the broad-minded generosity of spirit and the erudite elegance of prose of the late Dr. Stephen H. Webb, a convert to Catholicism who became a serious student of Mormonism. After receiving his Ph.D. from the University of Chicago, Stephen taught religion and philosophy for nearly 25 years at Wabash College. Later, he devoted himself more fully to writing, while also teaching at the Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis and serving in several prison ministries. The extent of his, quote, deeply felt mission to teach the beautiful truths of Mormonism to the wider world, end of quote, in his later life, was summarized in capsule form by an academic who was also a longtime family friend. Following Stephen's funeral services in Indianapolis, he told me that it was striking to him that after a remarkable academic career, in which Stephen wrote numerous articles and more than a dozen major volumes, each one taking up a topic that was very different from the one before, parenthetically writing not only about theology, but also about animals, vegetarianism, diet, politics, popular culture, including a book on musical career of Bob Dylan, literature and liberal advocacy, end of parenthesis, he dedicated his last three books, published with Oxford University Press, to the subject of Mormonism. After the funeral, I also met with Ruth Ellen Homer, LDS Indiana Area Interface Specialist, who related an experience she had with Stephen a few weeks prior to his passing. At my request, she wrote the following summary, which I include with the permission of both Ruth Ellen and Stephen's wife, Diane Timmerman. Quote, on February 18, 2016, Stephen came to my home for a living room dialogue of the Center for Interfaith Cooperation in Indianapolis. He fit right in with the other guests, including university professors who were CIC members. In preparing for the event, I had felt prompted by the Holy Ghost to teach the need for the restoration in a specific way. I worked on my outline and slides for days until the feeling came that everything was as the Lord wanted. Steve listened intently as I explained why Mormons believed the restoration was necessary. The apostles and apostolic keys had been lost in antiquity and were needed in the Latter-day Church. Ecumenical councils had assembled to consider weighty theological questions, but apostles were not present to declare doctrine. There were no apostles at Nicaea. Having built the foundation, I next showed a painting of Peter, James, and John ordaining Joseph Smith as the first apostle in modern times and conferring the apostolic keys upon him. Oliver Cowdery would be ordained next as the second modern apostle. Then I summarized in the words given me by the Spirit the week before, quote, this remarkable occasion is sacred to the Latter-day Saints. We believe the keys of the kingdom given to Peter were literally restored by Peter. End of quote. During this discussion, Steve had grown increasingly animated. Now in a climactic moment, he declared firmly, Peter held the keys of the kingdom. My friend Steve had once again voiced a beautiful truth of the gospel. As he left that evening, he turned to me and said, that was a good presentation. End of quote from Ruth Ellen Homer. Earlier, Stephen had written, what set Joseph Smith apart from the many mystics? This is a quote from Stephen Webb. What set Joseph Smith apart from the many mystics and prophets throughout history who have recorded their auditory and visual experiences of God was his sensitivity to the fragility of religious authority and his recognition that the traditions of the church needed to be reestablished on the grounds of a renewal of the prophetic tradition. In other words, he instinctively understood that religion without authority is merely passing fad or speculative fantasy. Joseph reinvented the theological wheel of apostolic succession. The idea that the leadership of the church should be in the hands of men who are spiritual heirs of the original ministry of the 12 apostles. And the Petrine primacy, the idea that Jesus singled out Simon Peter to hold the first place of honor and authority among the apostles. That should not cast him in a negative light to Roman Catholics. Indeed, it should affirm Catholics in their understanding of religious authority. End of quote from Stephen Webb. The testimony of Dennison Lott Harris not only underscores the importance of the circumstances that brought the keys held by Peter back to the earth again, but also the events of 26 March 1844 that assured that the authority and power of those same keys would continue in the leading quorums of the Church after the death of Joseph Smith. Though at first, after the martyrdom, Brigham Young had sorrowfully wondered whether Joseph Smith had taken the keys of the kingdom with him at his death, he was soon fired through with a burst of inspiration that told him all was well. Bringing my hand down on my knee, I said that the keys of the kingdom are right here with the church. All those keys of the priesthood, including the last and most sacred key of the sealing power that was specifically conferred on Brigham Young, have continued with the first presidency in the 12 to the present day. Andrew Ehat summarizes the enduring legacy of 26 March 1844. Quote, John Taylor, the successor to Brigham Young as president of the church, received an admonition from the Lord for the church to, quote, fear me and observe my laws, and I will reveal unto you from time to time, through the channels that I have appointed, everything that shall be necessary for the future development and perfection of my church, for the adjustment and rolling forth of my kingdom, and for the building up and the establishment of my Zion. End of quote. The channels had been appointed. The process of succession was set. The flow of revelation has continued. This is the continuing influence of Joseph Smith's last charge. End of quote from Andrew Ehat. Never, ever again, Elder Gary E. Stevenson of the 12 has declared, do we have to question, where are the keys? Epilogue. Dennison Lott Harris received his temple blessings in early February 1846. Brigham Young had closed the temple 2 days earlier, fearing that any further delay in leaving Nauvoo would increase the risk of violence from the enemies of the church. However, after seeing a crowd of saints that had gathered anxiously at the entrance to the temple, President Young relented, and a huge swell of ordinances were performed over the next 2 days. 512 people were given their endowments on February 6, and on the next and last day in which temple ordinances were administered in Nauvoo, over 600 received them. Poignantly, Dennison was endowed not only on that final day, but also as part of the ninth and last company that completed the ordinance sometime after midnight in the wee hours of 8 February. Although we will never know the full story of what happened, it is not inconceivable that a day or two prior to the exodus from Nauvoo, Brigham remembered his promise to the prophet to make sure that Dennison received his endowment in the Nauvoo temple, as administered under the direction of the Quorum of the Twelve, Joseph Smith's authorized successors. This has been a recording of an article originally published in Interpreter, a Journal of Mormon Scripture, Volume 21, 2016, read by Jeffrey M. Bradshaw. This audio recording is copyrighted under a Creative Commons license and may be freely distributed if it remains unchanged, the journal and its website are credited, and is for non-commercial use. A printed version of this and many other articles and resources on Mormon Scripture can be found at mormoninterpreter.com.